It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This weekend's shooting death of an unarmed black teenager by a white Madison police officer sparked protests in the city throughout the weekend. They apparently will continue throughout the week.
As the state's Division of Criminal Investigation examines the case, in accordance with a new state law, activists are calling for justice for Tony Robinson.
We'll talk with Madison's police chief, Mike Colville, in a few minutes. First, we'll check in with WPR's own state government reporter, Sean Johnson. Sean, welcome to the show.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Sean, I understand you've been following Madison Mayor Paul Soglin today and what he has had to say. What have we heard from him on this issue?
Yeah, Mayor Soglin held a pretty somber press conference this morning where he said that this city is in the midst of one of the most tragic episodes in the history of Madison, in his words. And he went on at some length about how this is a bigger societal problem and, you know, not really speaking to the specifics of the incident that happened on Friday or the investigation that's now ongoing. When he was asked if he had any advice for people who are so frustrated with the Robinson incident that they consider taking matter into their own hands or being disruptive, you know, along the lines of what happened in Ferguson, the mayor said, "I'm not sure I have to say anything. This is Madison, Wisconsin, and I've got tremendous faith in the people of this community in leading themselves." He also outlined a couple ways in which Madison had, at least so far, responded better than Ferguson. The mayor said he met personally with Robinson's mother on Friday, and that the police chief had also met with Robinson's grandmother, and that they were trying to emphasize that the tragedy here is, I guess, being felt by the Robinson family, that while there are multiple tragedies going on, and that people in the police department may be mourning as well for their colleague and what he's going through, that they were focusing on the tragedy being felt by the Robinson family. And so that was different than what you'd seen in Ferguson.
And Sean, this is a statewide issue because of a state law on investigations of these police-involved shootings. What did we hear today from the state's Department of Justice?
It is. It's a brand new law, and it is going to be handled here by a brand new Attorney General Brad Schimmel. And he issued a statement today saying that because officer-involved incidents involve considerable resources, they've assigned teams of agents from Department of Justice Division of Criminal Investigation offices around the state, and that they were taking care to avoid tainting the statements of witnesses so that the information that they got from those witnesses, they could be sure was coming from what they knew from the scene or from the incident itself and not from media accounts. And basically what that law requires is that an investigation is conducted by at least two investigators, neither of whom is employed by the law enforcement agency that employs the law enforcement officer that was involved in the officer-involved death. So, I mean, I guess the point is that these are not Madison officers conducting this investigation. And the DOJ statement said that it will be up to Dane County District Attorney Ishmael Azan to review the facts and then to issue a public statement on his conclusions. And it's actually just the role of the DOJ to obtain the facts. So DOJ does the investigation, submits them to the DA, and he reaches a conclusion.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today and
You're
following
welcome.
The story. WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson. We'll now go to Craig Spaulding. He is a community activist in Madison. He is at a press conference on this issue. He's the father of one of Tony Robinson's friends. Craig Spaulding, thank you for joining us.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you.
So how are you and your son doing in the aftermath of this tragedy?
We're, pretty stunned and exhausted and grieving. I'm very worried about the kids. This group of kids had just lost their good friend, Jaden McRaven, that's fallen from the building downtown on campus at Christmas time. And so we spent the whole week of Christmas planning that funeral. And now this is just a lot for kids of this age to deal with.
Now, we've heard hundreds, over 1,000 students, high school and college students, demonstrating today at the Capitol, by the city-county building. What do you hope comes out of these protests and the city, the state's response to it?
Well, I was there marching with them, and it was incredibly peaceful. I think by them marching and chanting and singing and being able to get this frustration out in a peaceful way is really, really good. There's starting to be a little bit of dialogue with the police. I can tell you the police, Madison Police Department, are being tremendous in blocking the streets and working with the organizers of the marches. And although this is a pretty organic march, it takes its twists and turns. And I do believe that there's going to be some healing. I don't think there's any fear. There should be any fear of anything happening like what happened in Ferguson and other places, because even number one, this is Madison. There's a lot of love and peace here, and they're getting it out. They're getting their frustration out productively.
As we just heard from Sean Johnson, this investigation is in the hands of an outside agency, not the local city police. Do you get a sense, being involved with these protests, that people have faith that this investigation will tell us what we need to know?
I do not. In fact, I am very close to Anthony and Javier, whose apartment this happened at. And they were detained on Friday night by the Madison Police Department and taken to the police station where the DCI, you know, Division of Criminal Investigation for the State Department of Justice, was. And they held the two boys and questioned them, and we tried to get attorneys for them. I took two attorneys in with me, and they were denied any kind of representation. It makes me a little bit nervous that someone as close, you know, to the Madison Police Department is, I do believe this is a good law. I think it should be more independent than what it is now.
So there's a press conference going on right now. I gather you just stepped away from it to talk to us. What are the key
Correct.
Demands that protesters have from the Madison City Police, Madison City government?
Well, they would like to speak to Chief Colwell. They would like to see the officer put into custody. And they would like to see justice, you know, in an extremely transparent investigation. Those are the main demands right now.
What do you
You know, when the phone call was made back to 911, 911 dispatch was made fully aware that this young man was unarmed. And to have an outcome like this is just incredibly tragic, incredibly tragic.
What do you think needs to be done to rebuild trust between Madison Police and the younger community, especially the younger minority community in the area?
I don't know. It's a good question. There's a lot of rebuilding of trust that needs to take place. They need to work with them, you know, work together in the street. They need to be more transparent than what they are being right now. There's a lot of rebuilding to do, although I think that by allowing these protests to happen, and I do give Chief Colwell a lot of credit for blocking the streets and doing what we have the First Amendment right to do, is going a long way in rebuilding the trust now. The officers are being extremely helpful in allowing these to happen. So, you know, that's a lot. And these kids, I think, also understand that it's not, you know, every cop like this, but they do have an immense fear of walking on the street right now by themselves, whether it's daylight or nighttime.
Craig, thank you for taking the time today, and I'm sorry for
You're
the loss
welcome.
For you and your family.
Thank you very much.
That's Craig Spaulding, a community activist, the father of one of Tony Robinson's friends.
We're continuing our conversation about this weekend's officer-involved shooting in Madison. We just heard from community activist Craig Spaulding.
Now we turn to Madison Police Chief Mike Koval. Due to the ongoing investigation of Tony Robinson's death, we cannot talk about the specifics of the case, but we do want to talk about the police department's approach going forward. Chief Koval, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So again, knowing that you can't talk about the details of the investigation, but in the absence of information, people might be drawing conclusions about the circumstances behind the shooting, whether it was justified. What do you want to say to people as we wait for the release of more information?
Well, in the interim, as is the case with anybody charged or potentially going to be charged with something in the criminal justice system, it would suggest that we have to wait due process dictates as much as does fundamental fairness. And once DCI has done their comprehensive review, including all the forensics, all the technology dumps, all of the witnesses that may or may not be present, when all of that's said and done, and then they've made their referral over to the DA's office, there's yet a second tier of scrutiny. So I think that if we want to get it right, we can't rush and ensure that we're going to get all the witnesses and all the context that need to be vetted before we can come to a good conclusion.
And Chief Koval, one question that a lot of people seem to be asking as you look on social media and protests and elsewhere, why didn't the officer use a taser instead of a gun? And again, without talking specifically about this case, can you describe for us what goes into an officer's decision, maybe even training, to use lethal versus non-lethal available options?
Well, we start from the predicate that when any time we have an encounter which could involve the use of force, we start from the predicate that the officer should opt for that minimal amount of non-deadly force required in order to affect control of the subject. So the fact that deadly force was employed in this instance means that at some juncture, Officer Kenny, based on the facts, statements, and other considerations of this investigation, is going to have to articulate that he or another was an imminent threat of death or great bodily harm. That is the only justifiable context in which deadly force can be used. So until such time as that is explored, we won't be able to answer that question at this juncture.
You wrote in your blog today that you and your officers are also mourning this weekend's tragedy. You apologized repeatedly in that. How is this incident and the demonstration since then affecting your department right now?
Well, as I also made reference in that blog, is that Madison police officers are seamlessly living and contributing to the livelihood of this entire community. It's not like we've led compartmentalized lives. We also share the range of emotions that do others have. But we also understand that we're in a unique position, that we understand that a lot of these decisions are made in a dynamic that allows for a lot of second guessing. And so we understand that the community is grieving, as are we. And now it's time for us to step up and to show everybody, to demonstrate what we want to be. We don't want to be a legacy of a department that shoots first and asks questions later. We want to be that department which shows our capacity to be engaging, to be relational, to be in our communities and in our neighborhoods, and to be someone that the public can trust. And right now, obviously, we have a trust gap, and we're going to work diligently to forge that gap.
So how do you do that? How do you work to build, restore trust between police and especially the local African-American community going forward?
Well, first of all, it means reaching out to our external stakeholders. I go to meetings. I meet with constituents. Our officers are not recluses. They're not abandoning the neighborhoods or anything like that. In fact, I've encouraged my officers even more so to park the car, to walk the beat, to get into the food court of the malls. Let people understand that we are persons that emerge behind this badge and this gun. We want to show that side of the personalities of what we comprise.
As tragic as this event in and of itself was, it happens in this context of Ferguson, Missouri, and other police-involved shootings around the country. Do you feel like there's even more scrutiny, more of a national microscope on everything you do in this situation?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no escaping the fact that when you put a few variables on the table, namely, you have a young African-American man who is killed at the hands of the police in an encounter which suggests that he was unarmed at the time that he was slain, then whether I like it or not, whether I wish to distinguish myself as completely different from these other episodes, that narrative will land you in the same sort of plight or conundrum that Ferguson and others have found themselves in. That's a theme that has been played out all too often on a national plane. And now, regrettably, we too are a part of that discussion more than ever.
with Ferguson. There was just this Department of Justice report finding endemic racism in the department, very explicitly racist emails going around from police officers, supervisors, people at the courts. Leading up to this shooting here in Madison, some local activists said there is a problem with racism in the Madison Police Department. Do you think that racism is a problem in the police department that needs to be confronted?
Well, I'll tell you that it's certainly not one for which we hire for or you train for. We put conditions in place, costs and benefits for those who would be rogues to would engage in that kind of activity. We're constantly evaluating those processes, those procedures, which may have a de facto or unintended consequence that shows that sort of outcome. So, no, I don't think this is a department that is subject to racism. In fact, I will go back 6-7 years now where we're one of the first departments that actually trained our officers in getting in touch with unconscious bias proclivities, and so that they're aware of those things, and so that their stewards and their coworkers can be aware of those things, so that we can act as guardians not only to the community but towards one another to ensure that those sort of racist outcomes don't occur. So, no, I can't agree with that assessment.
So one contrast many reporters have made, both within Wisconsin and beyond, is between the handling of protests in Ferguson and here in Madison. What are your priorities as these protests, starting Friday night, going on through this week? What is your priority as a police chief?
Well, to take seriously our constitutional oath, mainly being we are there to protect constitutional rights and individual liberties. One of the most cherished in our country is the First Amendment, that right of assembly and free speech. So to that extent, we take very, very strongly the opportunity to show how good we can do in this context. We want to foster and facilitate those protests. Now, to the extent that we can, we will, and we will do everything in our power to make that a win-win proposition. The only thing that would, again, vitiate that objective is if people engage in wrongful conduct in the course of doing that. But in the most part, we have cut a wide berth in terms of facilitating parades and demonstrations and rallies to take place.
I believe one of the demands of the protests outside the city county building was to hear from Mayor Soglin. He came out and spoke, and to hear from you. Would you come out and address protesters at some point? Do you feel that that would be appropriate?
Well, it depends on those circumstances. So, for example, last night I was present during the vigil, but quite frankly, I took a role on the outer rim because I don't think that I should be or the police should be the object of a lot of these gatherings right now. We don't even have the capacity to say that Tony Robinson's been returned to his family for a proper, respectful opportunity to bury their young man. So I really don't think that the police ought to be the object of any focus right now. I think the community is rightfully focused on being respectful to this family and their needs.
And you, with Michael Johnson, from a local organization, had met with the members of the community and members of the family. What was that like?
Well, of course, it's very difficult. I was able to go with Michael to meet with Tony's grandmother and grandfather, and frankly, I was delighted that they would even have me just literally hours after the death of their son. To their credit, they were angry. Very, very angry, very, very, very touched by their loss. They did most of the talking, and I did most of the listening. But to their credit, at the end of it all, I couldn't be more gratified that they were at least willing to let me make my public apology to them as a family. I asked also that I be able to extend that to Tony's mom inside the house where we were staging, and obviously they felt that that would be too overwhelming, and I totally get that, totally respect that, and that's why I've used other platforms like the media, like opportunities like this or the blog to suggest what a tremendous sense of loss that I would have felt as well, since I have two adult sons, and I can't even imagine trying to get my hands around the thought that they wouldn't be coming home.
Heard earlier what you were hoping to see from the community. What are you telling your officers? What must be a tense time for them?
It is a tense time for them, and I'm asking them not only to be as good they are, but I'm asking them to now be great, to show this community, to show, frankly, our nation, how we can do things differently in Madison to lead to a more constructive, to a more reconciliatory process of healing. But it means that we can't go into hiding or recluse, as we've seen in some departments, where you only respond to calls for service, service the call, and get back into your car. Quite the contrary, I've asked my officers to park the car, get out and walk, get out and be visible, have those courageous conversations as people would allow. Go to the food court, go to the schools, play a game of horse on the basketball court. We need to show that we are members of the community as well. We're seamlessly interreliant and interdependent on one another, and we want to be able to come back to the discussion of ideas and to work with them as our partners in moving towards better community policing.
Chief Koval, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity. Have a great day.
You too. That's Madison Police Chief Mike Koval talking with us about how his police department is moving forward following the officer-involved death of Tony Robinson.
The proposed bill from a Wisconsin lawmaker could have some implications for when schools can and can't start in the state.
Per state law, schools can't start until the beginning of September, but the new bill would create an exemption to allow districts with 20% of students taking advanced placement courses to choose their own start dates.
Here with us to talk more about that idea is Jim Ott, Republican State Representative from Mequon. Representative Ott, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Well, first off, what's wrong with schools starting after September 1st as a whole?
Well, I think for a lot of school districts, probably nothing is wrong with it, and maybe it's even a benefit for parts of the state. But on the other hand, for parts of the state, it's not such a good idea. Certainly here in southeastern Wisconsin, where I live and where I represent, school superintendents would definitely like to have the opportunity to start before September 1st for a couple of reasons. Number one, a lot of students already back on campus for football practice or cross country or band or any other number of activities that go on. And number two, and really what we're targeting this bill to, is academic reasons, and that the advanced placement tests, which are set by the National College Board, are always in May. It's a date that's set nationally, and school districts don't have any control over that date. And the thinking is that a week or two of school before, an extra week or two of school before those tests, rather than that extra week or two of school after the test, would probably be more beneficial to the students. And it's one of those things where if you talk to school superintendents, I think you will find generally they would like to be able to start school when the school board would like to start school. And I think the other thing is we're not talking about starting school in the middle of July. I think in most cases you would be talking about maybe the Monday before Labor Day, or in some cases maybe 2 weeks before Labor Day. But we're not talking about starting school 6 weeks earlier than what we do right now.
You said those tests that you're concerned with are in May, and that it would be better to have a couple more weeks of classes before rather than after. But given that they're at the end of the school year, isn't there ample opportunity for schools and students to make up that difference then? And it might be a wash whether 2 weeks there at the end might make a difference either way.
Well, you may be right about that. The other thing, though, is that, you know, I remember my time in school a long, long time ago. When it got to be Memorial Day, I pretty much was ready for summer vacation. I think a lot of students feel that way. That last week of school in June, the weather is getting nicer. You know, you've been there all year, and you're kind of looking forward to getting out and doing summer-type things. And I know myself, and I think a lot of students, when it gets to be toward the end of August, students are ready to go back to school. So it's not just a matter of that week or two after the test necessarily not helping with the test. I think there's other reasons, and that would be just the interest of the students in their general schoolwork.
Any concern that this could create have and have not districts that were more focused on academics, and maybe the perception that this was catering to those kids instead of all kids?
Well, we tried catering to all kids in the past. I introduced this bill that would have let any school district start before September 1st if they wanted to. And remember, a couple of things. Number one, when we say September 1st, you're really talking somewhat after September 1st in most cases, because if September 1st, say, lands on a Friday, well, schools aren't going to start school on Friday and then take a three-day weekend. They're probably going to start on the Tuesday after Labor Day, which I think most school districts do. So you're talking about September 3rd, 4th, or 5th. The other thing is, we're not mandating that schools start before September 1st. We would give the opportunity for the school board to make that determination, and I think that's one of the reasons that we have school boards. As far as your other point about whether we're making have and have not school districts, some school districts, you have a lot of students already taking the advanced placement test. Other school districts, you have fewer students taking the advanced placement test, and that's already in place. You know, some school districts, you have over 30% of the students taking advanced placement tests, and some school districts, you only have 10% taking the test. That's already in place. This really wouldn't influence how many students take the advanced placement test. That's already happening. And again, we're giving the school boards the right to make that decision. And I don't really feel, even if this were, say, statewide, every school district could make that choice. I think some school districts would continue to choose to start after September 1st.
You worried at all that this could just simply be confusing for families scheduling things, for friends who might be doing activities together, for camps, for work schedules for high school kids?
Well, the schools generally set their school start dates, like I think most of them have already set them now for next fall. And usually I think those decisions are made even in January and February. So certainly you'd know well ahead of time. Secondly, I think most school districts, you don't see a big change in the number of students taking the advanced placement test. In fact, the bill that I've introduced, if it were to become law, based on the latest statistics available, with the latest ones I had available when we wrote the bill was 2012-13, that school year, I think something like 32 out of the 424 school districts would have qualified for the earlier start date. So for the majority of school districts, the great majority of school districts under this bill were to pass, you would still be starting September 1st or later.
Now, as it stands right now, schools can apply for a waiver, which is available from the State Department of Public Instruction, that would let them start early if they so choose. Why not just keep that process in place instead of going forward with this bill for the AP schools?
Well, what the statutes currently say is the waiver can be obtained if there are extraordinary circumstances. That's the actual word that's used in the statute. And as far as extraordinary circumstances, if I were on a school board and I'd say, well, we want to start early because we think it's a good idea, we got half the kids on campus already, I doubt very much that would be considered extraordinary circumstances. And from my understanding, very, very few school districts are granted a waiver. It generally does take some sort of an extraordinary circumstance to get that waiver.
Now, as you've mentioned, the tourism industry, or maybe we haven't hit on this quite yet, but the tourism industry in the past, I should say, has opposed this idea and seems likely to do so again. So if this bill is passed, would it be a blow to the tourism industry and, as a result, maybe the state's economy?
Well, I can tell you that the tourism industry is already opposing this bill, as well as the Wisconsin Hotel and Lodging Association and the Wisconsin Association of Convention and Visitors Bureau. I didn't know ahead of time that these groups would oppose the bill. That it, after the bill was circulated for co-sponsors is when their opposition became apparent. I was hoping that because of the relatively small number of schools that would be affected, and a lot of them, like I say, are in southeastern Wisconsin, I was hoping maybe the opposition wouldn't be there. But honestly, I wouldn't want to do anything to hurt our tourism industry. It's a fantastic, you know, one of the big three in the state. Manufacturing, agriculture, and tourism are three big industries. I don't really think this bill as drafted would have any impact on the tourism industry. And I know there's thoughts about, well, the weather is nicer at the end of August than it is at the beginning of June. Actually, the weather average temperatures are about the same. The water tends to be warmer in late August than it is in early June. But I really wonder how many families are like taking a week vacation leading up to Labor Day. A lot of families I know with kids are, you know, getting ready for the kids to go back to school on Labor Day weekend. They're going out and doing shopping for school clothes and things the week before. So I don't really feel this would have a big impact, if any impact, on our tourism industry. And obviously I can understand why they would disagree with the concept of this bill, and probably if I were in their situation, I would as well. But, I mean, if you really think about it, 32 school districts out of over 400, we're talking about most of the state would still be starting September 1st or later.
And just to go back to the tourism, the idea being not just that families might not take those vacations at the end of August, but that the workers there, that the kids who are in high school who have summer jobs would not be available suddenly at the end of a couple of weeks when the tourism, the summer tour season is still going strong.
You're absolutely correct, but I'll tell you what, for the school districts that would qualify in, say, northern Wisconsin or the Wisconsin Dells area or, say, in Door County, those school boards could make the decision to start after the 1st of September. We're not telling them they have to start before. So the other thing is, out of these 32 school districts, I'm not even sure how many of them would actually make that choice. So we're giving some autonomy to the school boards, but it's only a relatively few school boards across the state, and they still would have the opportunity to start after September 1st if they felt their area was going to be negatively impacted by the idea of the school starting, say, the 3rd or the 4th or the 5th Monday in August.
Do you have any sense of how much demand there might be for schools to start earlier?
Well, I know in my district, and where this idea first came from, when I first was in office in the winter of 2007, one of the things I did was just visit with the school superintendents in my district, and we have four high schools in the 23rd Assembly District. It was a little different at that time because of redistricting. That's changed a little bit, but a couple of the school districts are still the same. But I visited with all the superintendents, you know, to see how things are going. Is there any concerns they have, anything the legislature should know about? And that's where this idea arose. The superintendent said, well, we sure would like to be able to start school before September 1st. And again, these are school districts in southeastern Wisconsin, the Milwaukee area and north of Milwaukee. I wasn't going around to northern Wisconsin and asking school superintendents. And again, largely this bill would not affect any part of the state except those districts where you got the more than 20% participation rate in the advanced placement test. And in those 32 districts or whatever the number would be year to year, those school boards would have the choice of saying yes or no to September 1st.
Representative Ott, thank you so much for joining us.
Very good to be with you, Veronica.
We've been speaking with Jim Ott, Republican State Representative from Mequon.
Coming up, Wisconsin is the latest flashpoint in the ongoing national focus on police-involved shootings of black men after this weekend's incident in Madison. We want to hear your thoughts in the aftermath of this weekend's police-involved shooting of Tony Robinson in Madison. You can call in at 800-642-1234. As we've heard in the news, an investigation is ongoing, but the event is being seen in the wider narrative of police shootings of unarmed black men around the country.
Call in now at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to change to prevent future incidents like this? If you're in Madison, were you involved in the protests? And if you're not in Madison, is this something that could happen in your community? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
If you're in law enforcement or a member of a minority community in your area, we'd like to hear from you. How much tension is there from your perspective? What would need to happen to improve things? Again, the number is 800-642-1234, and we've got a post at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller. We've got David on the line in Hudson now. David, hi.
Hi. I'm calling, and this might be, some people might think it's a little off base, but I'm kind of concerned that police all around the country seem to be shooting to kill, and being trained to use guns, just in the Wisconsin hunter safety thing, we went through pistols, the whole nine yards. I'm just concerned that there's no there's no police training where they're shooting someone in a leg. It always seems to be choosing to do fatal shots and multiple shots. Recently in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, the police chased somebody. The guy got out with a knife, and they were more than 100 feet from the guy, fatally shot him and his girlfriend with rifles. And I'm just concerned that the police are, when they choose to fire, it always seems to be multiple fatal shots.
I see. Thanks a lot for the call, David, at 800-642-1234.
And we go next to Michelle joining us from Eau Claire. Michelle, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I am calling in because I am the wife of a law enforcement officer, and it's been very difficult to listen to all of these different things over the past even year. As I sit at home, sometimes worrying about my husband's safety, and I really thought that it was important to bring up that, you know, officers are killed every single day by all different races of people, black, white, Asian, Mexican, and we're not talking about that when they are putting their lives on the line.
Michelle, thank you so much for calling.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts. We're getting your reactions to the police-involved shooting in Madison this weekend. What do you think needs to change to improve relations between police and minority communities around the state, around the country? What would you like to see change to prevent these kind of incidents, these fatal shootings? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got Dave on the line in Sussex now. Dave, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I agree with the last caller 100%, and I think what we need to change is people need to be more responsible about their actions and what they do with themselves that affects everyone around them and their community. And when an officer makes a choice to use deadly force, there's a good reason behind that. We have to look at the facts and what happened in the case. It's my understanding that there was he grabbed for the weapon, the officer felt his life was in danger, and the use of deadly force was justified in my eyes from the facts that I have. We need to protect our officers and support our officers that protect our lives, the lives of our children, our families, our communities. Our livelihoods depend on people conducting themselves in the right way so we can prosper as a country, as a community. It's the people that aren't conducting themselves right.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. And, of course, the details of this case aren't under investigation by the Wisconsin Department of Justice. A lot of the facts and details still not released intentionally so as not to contaminate potential witnesses.
And we go next to Frank. Frank joins us from Onalaska. Frank, hello.
Hi. And I've got a couple of relatives who have been police officers. But I question, in all of these cases, police procedures, whether it's the knock and due process and entry in Madison and lack of a warrant. In the cases of the video of five officers not being able to take down a homeless man, if I was chief, I would question whether these officers were doing the right thing in terms of the training. And as my understanding is, deadly force is the norm. There is no such thing as wound to kill.
Frank, appreciate you calling.
Go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Oh, actually, our last ready caller just dropped off the line. I'll remind you that we are taking your calls, your reactions, your thoughts on the police-involved shooting, both the one in Madison this weekend, one in Milwaukee that's gotten attention over the last year. Ferguson, what needs to happen to prevent these situations? What needs to happen to improve relations between police and minority communities in towns and cities around the country? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Pat is on the line in Brookfield. Pat, hi.
Got a brilliant idea for everybody. If you get in trouble with the police, if they pull you over, if they chase you, if you do something wrong and you get caught, you voluntarily let them place you in the car. Don't say anything. Wait till you get to the station and talk to them there. Don't try to fight them. Don't try to punch them. Don't try to charge them. Don't try to take their weapon, and nobody will get hurt. Very simple. It's called common sense.
Pat, thanks for your call. Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, we have archived conversations from earlier today, both here on Central Time and the Joy Cardine Show, on the issue of police-involved shootings.
We're talking about this weekend's shooting death of Tony Robinson in Madison, officer related. The investigation is being conducted by the Wisconsin Department of Justice. And we're getting your reaction right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go next to John, who's joining us in Shawano. John, hi.
Well, hello.
What do you think?
Well,
Unfortunately, these days, everything is going directly to race. I was a correctional officer back in the 90s, juvenile, at Ethan Allen School, which is unfortunately closed down now, west of Milwaukee, Wales, Wisconsin. Back in the 90s, business was booming because of violent crime in Milwaukee, Janesville, Racine, by mostly African-American juveniles. But you could get across race lines very easily back in the 90s. Now, and talk to people. It doesn't matter what color you are. But now everything seems to be going black and white, just the race issue, instead of the individual. It comes down to the individual, whether it be Ferguson, whether it be whatever the details come out with this Madison case. But it comes down to the individual, not the race.
John, appreciate you calling.
We're going out to Jeremy with us in Duluth, Minnesota. Jeremy, hi.
Hi.
Jeremy, go ahead.
I just to ask or maybe make a point, I wonder what responsibility the media has to wait until all the facts come in before they make this such a public issue and feed the fire. You know, there's a trial, there's a process that has to occur. Why not wait until that process goes through and then whether or not, you know, find out where the liability exists before they bring it to the forefront? And I'll take any comments off there. Thank you.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for the call. I'll just say I can't really defend or attack the media given my position. It's a tough call. I'll just say that from behind the scenes. But thank you for bringing up that point.
And next we go to Pete joining us in Montello. Hi, Pete.
Hi, good afternoon. You know, it is what it is, but I really believe that a lot of it has to do with the media. Because the media, what they do is they bait the public. They keep saying it's a white officer shot a black man for a black team. What does the officer being white or the perpetrator being black have anything to do with it? It's an American shooting another American who was either doing something wrong or was in trouble or whatever the circumstances are. But the media is the one who keeps bringing the race into these incidents. Thank you for your time.
Pete, appreciate your call. Pete's saying that the media is framing this as a race issue and that he thinks adds to the factors here that we're talking about. What do you think? You can call us at 800-642-1234.
We've got Steve on the line next in Douglas County. Steve, hi.
Hi. Now, some of your callers had it right on. When the police tell you you're under arrest, your fight is not there. It's in court. And the other thing is, the police don't shoot at people to try to wound them or shoot the gun out of their hand. That's almost impossible for people who are Olympic class shooters to do. And the police don't get to train like that. Police officers, when they fire their weapon, that's considered deadly force. There's a high likelihood that it will cause death or great bodily harm, which are also the circumstances under which police are authorized to use deadly force. In most of these cases, if these people would have done what the police told them to, they'd still be alive today.
Steve, thanks for the call. Thanks to everyone who called. You can keep sharing your thoughts on police-involved shootings and the incident in Madison over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, a Wisconsin business owner will share how right-to-work legislation could change his business and his life. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.